So good evening, Rishus Harav. Thank you all for having me. Thank you, Rabbi Kanofsky, for inviting me in to deliver this segment of the Megillah Shiurim. As I mentioned, and as you can see on the source sheet, I figured we'd start with a little bit of a background. From what I understand, it's been quite a number of weeks since you've had the previous lecture, the previous chapter of Megillah, chapter 6. So we'll begin there. I put a short summary on the sheet in case you don't want to follow along. But if you look through in the Megillah, you'll notice the chapter 6, verse 1, opens with, "That night sleep eluded the king, and he ordered that the record book, the annals, be brought and read before the king, so the king can't sleep." And then there was found recorded that Mordechai had denounced Bigsana and Teresh, two of the king's chamberlains of the Guardians of the Threshold, who had plotted to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And again, the king finds out he never paid Mordechai back for saving his life. Anyways, the king says, what was done? The king's pages say, oh, nothing was ever done, actually. You know, he was never paid back for what he did to save your life. Great, says the king. Vayomer HaMelech, in verse 4, the king said, who's in the court? Okay. And Haman was in the court. Okay, king goes to Haman. King says, Haman, what would you do to honor someone? How would you honor someone who the king wants to honor? And Haman is, of course, thinking, oh, yeah, that's me. Great. He says, well, I'll tell you what to do. You've got to parade him around in fancy clothing on the king's horse. He gets the royal crown either on his head or on the horse's head, actually, according to the different commentaries there. And anyways, the king actually turns this around and forces Haman to do all of this to Mordechai. And in fact, the Midrash fills in various, you know, details to the story of how Haman is forced to be his barber and to bathe him and all sorts of other demeaning things that Haman has to do in order to take care that Mordechai be rewarded in this way that Haman had thought would be happening to himself. Okay? Anyways, by the time you finish down all of Ahasuerus' instructions to Haman and Haman actually carrying them out, you get to verse 12. And verse 12 is very, very, very important as an introduction to our chapter. So we're on page 38, 39 now. Mordechai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried home, despondent and with his head covered. This is all, until now, a very nice story. It's great, Mordechai's the good guy, Haman's the bad guy, Mordechai gets paraded by Haman, everybody's so happy, Haman thinks he's going to get a great honor, he's the one. And again, the Midrash fills in various extra details here, and Haman had, you know, his family's wastebasket dumped on his head because they thought Mordechai would be the one, you know, leading Haman on the horse. And there's all sorts of different details that are filled in, and the point is, of course, to emphasize really the beginning of the turnaround and how Haman is replaced by Mordechai and Mordechai is replaced by Haman in this story. But here's the problem, as we just read, Mordechai returns to the king's gate. What was Mordechai doing at the king's gate? And what were we most recently told that he was doing there? He had torn his clothes. He was in mourning. He didn't know what to do. While this is a great story, it doesn't solve the problem. Nothing's really changed about the fate of the Jews. The Jews remain in terrible danger. Yes, you're right. It's a nice thing. We can laugh at Haman. Ha ha, Haman, you know. But the decree is still there. The Jews are still in danger, and frankly, again, it's very nice that we see Mordechai getting rewarded in this way, but it doesn't do anything for the nation. So Mordechai returns home, and Haman returns home. Now, right at the end after that, we do get a little glimmer of hope, because Haman tells his wife Zeresh about what had happened, and Zeresh says a very important line in the middle of verse 13, "If Mordechai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will undoubtedly fall before him." It's interesting, you may want to note the Hebrew words here as well, that Zeresh tells Haman, although they likely weren't speaking in Hebrew, obviously the Megillah is recorded in Hebrew, it says, "Ki nafol tipol lefanav," you will surely fall in front of him. Zeresh tells her husband, if you've started falling, and you've started being taken down, so to say, by Mordechai, know that this will continue, you will continue to fall. And in fact, the chapter 6, ends leading directly into our chapter, which is that again, a strict reminder that the story hasn't really been changed all that much. Again, this is a subplot, but the real plot is Esther meeting with Ahasuerus, Esther meeting with Haman, and the different meals that she wished to have with them. So we're reminded that in the last verse again, Odam medavrim imo, they are still talking, Visarisei HaMelech Higiu, and they, king's chamberlains, arrived, and they hurried to bring him to the banquet which Esther had arranged. So now we're getting back to real life. The subplot is over, and we're resuming the main plot of the Megillah. So I figured the way I would run this now from here, now that we've got some background, and we know that we're resuming, again, that sort of central theme, the central plot of the Jews are going to be killed, how are the Jews going to be saved? I figured I'd first read through the chapter a little bit with the Hebrew and English kind of quickly, and then go back, and what I'd like to present is really two distinct elements to this shiur. The first element I'd like to present is not directly taken from the classic commentaries, the way they were written in their order on the actual Megillah, on the actual Scroll of Esther, but rather the way the Talmud arranges its commentary, so to say. The Megillah is very unique. Megillat Esther is very unique in that the Talmud in, you know, the Babylonian Talmud actually arranges a number of statements based on the actual order of the text and presents it almost sort of like a commentary is presented. We don't really have that elsewhere in the Talmud referring to any other text that's part of Tanakh, that's part of the Bible. This seems to be quite unique in that way. So I figured I would take a couple of the selections from the Talmud which are presented, again, almost as a commentary. That would be the first part of this sort of lecture and the way we're going to look at it and try to see what are the themes that they are trying to bring out of this chapter and with their comments. And then after that, to look through what really I believe is the approach of the Ibn Ezra, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, one of the earlier Rishonim, a medieval Ashkenazi, I believe he was in different lands, he traveled throughout different places, but he had a commentary that was written on a lot of the Tanakh, and that was written about 1100 or so. And he has a very unique approach to the different drashot, to the different midrashim and exegetical comments that the rabbis make on the Megillah in and of itself, and how he sort of interprets those and what we can learn from that. So let's begin by reading through the chapter. So 7:1, we're again on page 38-39. Vayavo HaMelech veHaman, the king and Haman arrive, lishtot im Esther HaMalka, to feast, to drink with Esther the queen, with Queen Esther. Vayomer HaMelech leEsther, the king said to Esther, Gam again, Vayom HaSheni b'mishteh HaYayin, on the second day of the feast of wine, Ma she'elatech Esther HaMalka v'tinatin lach. What's your request, Queen Esther? I'll give it to you. It shall be given to you. Uma v'kashatech, what is, again, another word for what is your petition here? The translation slightly differs. Ad chatziya malchut v'teyas. Even if it's up to half the kingdom, I'll fulfill it. So they're sitting down at the meal. Vatan Esther hamalka v'tomar. And Ahasuerus has now asked Esther, what do you want? She says, you know what? Im matzati chen be'inecha melech. If I found favor in your eyes, king. V'mal hamelech tov. And if everything's good with you, king. Tinaten li nafshi b'she'elati. Whoa, this came out of nowhere. Ahasuerus thinks Esther maybe wants, you know, some new jewelry. All of a sudden, no. She says, give me my nation, my soul, v'ami b'vakashati. Let my life be granted to me as my request and my people as my petition. Ki nimkarnu ani v'ami lehashmid laharog ulabed. For we've been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, slain, annihilated. And had we just been sold as slaves and servant girls, I would have been quiet. For the adversary is not worthy of the king's damage. Okay, and we'll actually focus on that line as one of the first things that we talk about from the Talmud here. So at this point, Ahasuerus is quite stunned. She's taken him out to a couple of nights, you know, in a fancy restaurant. And he doesn't know what she's going to ask for, and she says, you got to spare me and my nation. He says, what's going on? Who's attacking you and your nation? The king says, okay, and the Hebrew here is very strange. Again, something else we're going to talk about. Vayomer HaMelech Ahasuerus should be translated as, and King Ahasuerus says, Vayomer l'Esther amalka, and he said to Queen Esther, we said that he said. Why so many sayings? And again, something else I'd like to look at later. Mihu ze ve'ezehu? Who is this person? Where is he? Asher mela'o libo lasos kein. He who dared to do this. Vatomer Esther, and Esther said, Ish tzar ve'oyev haman hara hazeh. An adversary and an enemy, this wicked Haman, v'Haman ivas milifnei ha'melech v'amalkan. Haman trembles in terror before the king and the queen. V'amelech kamach ha'matom ishte ayayin el ginat ha'bitan. And the king gets up in his anger and goes to the palace garden. V'aman amad levakesh ha'mafshom yester ha'malkan. And Haman realizes that he's going to have to beg for his life, and he remains to beg Esther for his life. Ki ra'aki chaltai elav ha'ram eit ha'melech. For he saw the king's evil determination against him was final. He sees that the king is serious about this. He's in big, big trouble. And the king returns to the banquet room. And Haman is falling. Falling down. Where is he falling? He didn't trip. Maybe he tripped, actually. Again, another comment that we're going to talk about from the classical commentaries in the Talmud. He was falling al hamita, on the bed asher Esther aleha, that Esther was lying on. So you can imagine Ahasuerus walks through the door, and he sees Esther, you know, sitting up in bed, and Haman falling over her. Vayomer hamelech, and the king says, Hagam lichboshet hamalka imi babayit, are you kidding me? You're trying to assault the queen with me right here? Hadavar yatza mipi hamelech, ufnei Haman chafu. As soon as the king uttered this, they covered Haman's face. And now we meet an old character that we may not have remembered. Vayomer Harvona. There's a person by the name of Harvona. If you look all the way, 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 way back in chapter 1, and you can flip there if you want. If you look, it's on page 1819, chapter 1, verse 10. Okay? And he is named, Harvona there is named, as one of the seven chamberlains who attended King Ahasuerus. He's actually in the same list. Perhaps he seems to be a bad guy from what we know about him so far. But Harvona comes and he says, Echad min hasarisin lefnei ha'melech, he was one of, again, the king's chamberlains, as we mentioned. And he says in front of the king, Gam hinei ha'is asher asah Haman, hey, look, there's this tree which Haman made, Le'Mordechai, for Mordechai asher diber tov al ha'melech. You remember Mordechai, king? He's the one who saved you. He told you about Bigtan and Teresh's evil plot. And, you know, Haman, he was going to try to hang this Mordechai. And it's Omeid Bevet Haman, it's standing in Haman's house, Gavoa Chamishim Amah, and it's 50 cubits tall. That's quite tall. I mean, depending on how we measure cubits, it's still quite tall. However you measure cubits, that's a lot of feet up. 75 feet, 100 feet, somewhere in between, around there. You know, Vayomer HaMelech, and the king decides, Teluhu Alav, hang him on it. And they hang Haman on the gallows, on the tree which he had prepared for Mordechai, and the king's anger abated. So this is basically the story of this chapter. Haman, being the great adversary of the Jews, is actually killed at this point, and Ahasuerus has resolved to take care of his wife and save her and her nation from destruction. Right, this is just simply step one of that. So at least that's sort of begun. Now I wanted to take a look at a couple of things that I feel illustrate why this is really the turning point of the Megillah. Some would argue it was last chapter. Some would argue maybe it's the next chapter when the, you know, the edicts are sent out from the king to say, don't kill the Jews, or the Jews may defend themselves, or however we're going to go through that. And that's as follows. One of the classic approaches to looking for hidden messages in the Megillah is what the usage of the Megillah, the usage of the word Hamelech, the king, in the Megillah. The Talmud, a number of times, as well as various other commentaries, in fact, there are even commentaries that are built on this principle, which is that Hamelech literally means the king. And what these, you know, authorities posit is that when you have the word Hamelech appearing without Ahasuerus following it, meaning it doesn't say King Ahasuerus, but rather just says the king, that may be referring either to Ahasuerus, but it can also, in each case, be referring to the king, meaning God. So if we look back at the beginning of chapter 6, Balayla ha'hun adidashinat ha'melech, on that night, the sleep of the king was disturbed. What does it mean, the sleep of the king? It doesn't say the sleep of the king, Achashverosh. So Rabbi Tanchum says in source number 2 on the source sheet, the verse alludes to another king who could not sleep, and whose sleep was disturbed? The sleep of the king of the universe, the Holy One, blessed be he, was disturbed. At this point, the Jewish people's prayers reached God, and God was, so to say, disturbed. God was maybe angry. God couldn't sleep, so to say. And that's what happens in the beginning of chapter 6. When is this reversed, though? When do both Achashverosh and God calm down? Well, looking back to the last verse that we just read, Vachamat HaMelech Shachacha, the king's anger calmed down, abated, and said, in fact, says the Talmud there as well, in the next little citation as part of number 2, the verse states, okay, Vachamat HaMelech Shachacha, then the king's wrath was assuaged, Shachacha. The Gemara asks, why are there two assuagings here? What does it mean, Shachacha? Okay, the commentaries differ as to what the Hebrew should precisely be. It perhaps could have said Shacha, but the word Shachacha seems to be that there were two things going on. So you know what the Gemara answers? Again, one is referring to God, and one is referring to Achashverosh. So now we've been disturbed. Starting from the beginning of the last chapter, now the anger is gone. The anger at Haman is gone, and sort of the same disturbed, unable to sleep, not knowing what's going on, that's also been something that changed. So again, prior to this chapter, coming in, we've got an upset king, we've got an upset God. Coming out of this chapter, though, we now have a calm God, a calm king, things are starting to set themselves up. And this is sort of the first illustration that you have that this is really the major turning point of the Megillah, where the approach both down on our world of Achashverosh being upset and worried, why is it that, you know, my wife keeps on inviting me to these meals? What is the role of Haman in the Megillah? Why is he always hanging out? Is he up to no good? These questions that Achashverosh may have had now, with this episode, are finished. He's calmed down. And so too, when we say again God was sort of upset, couldn't sleep, whatever that means, so too now that's done. But there are a number of other sort of strange comments that the Gemara makes that I feel illustrate the importance and the turnaround that's in this chapter. If we continue through the next section of source number 2, source number 2 is just selections from the Talmud here in Masechet Megillah, that's 15b and 16a. I chose out little bits and pieces. It goes back to 7.4. So again, you can look back in your Megillot, that's on page, again, 38, 39. And when Esther is explaining to Achashverosh that her nation is in danger, she says, "V'ilu la'avadim lishfachot nimkarnu hecharashti." Were it to be, had we been sold as slaves and servant girls, I would have kept quiet. Ki ein hatzar shoveh b'nezek hamelech. And there are two ways to translate this Hebrew. One is, the adversary is not worthy of the king's damage. Okay? Meaning, if someone was just trying to sell us off as slaves, it wouldn't be worth it for you to go after them, so to say. The Talmud actually puts a spin on this. It changes around the meaning relative to this meaning. And it says, during the banquet, Esther said to Achashverosh, "For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to be annihilated. But if we had been sold merely for bondmen and bondwomen, I would have held my tongue, since the affliction would not have been worth the damage to the king." The Gemara explains that she said to him, this adversary, this tsar, is not concerned, eno shoveh, about the damage that he is constantly causing to the king. It's not that it's not worth, you know, the king's time, or it wouldn't have been worth the damage to the king to get me out of this. That's not the way the Talmud is explaining this line. The Talmud is explaining, in hatzar shoveh b'nezek hamelech, the tsar, the evil enemy, in this case Haman, is not concerned about the damage that he's doing to the king. Now, up until now, how do we view Haman? Haman, the king's greatest advisor, the most helpful to the king, always gives him, you know, the right advice. He's, you know, gotten rid of Vashti and then replaced her, and Haman's always in the thick of things. Haman's now given him this great idea about getting rid of the Jews. Haman seems to be someone who the king is always looking at as what? Being his biggest supporter, his biggest help, his best advisor. But what does Esther point out about Haman? Says, one second, let's look at this guy's track record. First, he was jealous of Vashti and killed her. As it has been explained that Memuchan, who suggested killing Vashti, was Haman. Right? The Gemara elsewhere associates Memuchan and Haman together. So number one, again, he said that Vashti should be killed. That was out of jealousy. Now he is jealous of me, says Esther, and desires to kill me. So, says Esther, look at what Haman's actually doing. He's not your biggest help. He's not your greatest advisor. He's constantly causing you damage. Don't you remember how much you were tearing out your hair once Vashti was killed? Can't you see that what he's doing to you is not, as you think, in one direction, very helpful, but the exact opposite? He's always causing you damage. He's always against you. And again, we move on to sort of the next stage of it. Vayomer HaMelech Achashverosh, Vayomer LeEsther HaMalka. And King Achashverosh said, and he said to Esther HaMalka, which we pointed out, the Hebrew is bizarre. And he said, where? What does that even mean? Vayomer, Vayomer Lamali, asks the Gemara. I'm reading in the Hebrew here, and you can say, follow along in the English. Why do I need it to say said and again said? So Amar Rabbi Abahu. Rabbi Abahu said, Bitchila al yedei tur giman. At first, he spoke to her through the translator. Translator? Who would interpret on his behalf, because he thought that she was a common woman of lowly ancestry. He assumed, listen, Esther's very good looking, but she doesn't come from a special royal family. There's nothing special about her. She's just a peasant. Me, on the other hand, we won't talk about Achashverosh's lineage. But what the Gemara tells us here is the first Vayomer is because he said it aloud, meaning he expected the translator to pass it on to Esther. He couldn't even talk to Esther because Esther was that much below him, despite the fact that she was who he took as his queen. She's just a regular person. But what happened is once Esther says, I'm a Jew, and says, the Gemara, very more clearly, once she told him, Kevan de Amra le mi de Beit Shaul ka'atina, once she told him that she came from the house of Saul, who was a king, immediately it says, Miyad vayomer le Esther Amalka, and he said directly to Esther. And so to here, we're learning something about what the rabbis are telling us from this. Up to this point, Esther is a regular peasant. Again, she's good looking, the king likes her, she won the Miss Shushan contest, and she became the queen, or maybe Miss 127 continents. But the king says she's nothing special. But now at this point we see a switch. Esther goes from being just someone plain to, whoa, she's royalty. This is serious. And so much so that Achashverosh now realizes, oh, I can talk to her face to face. I see some people have some bothered looks here.
First of all, his first wife was also from royalty.
Yep. Well, I mean, we're assuming that he did. The key here, as in a lot of Midrashim and comments similar to this, is to pick up on something in the text. In this case, the Vayomer Vayomer. But the point is that there's some sort of lesson and some sort of message that we can take out of it. Not always is it a message for our personal lives, although many times it is. I think that there are definitely some very good messages that we can take out a lot of these points, but it's also a message about sort of what's taking place in the rabbi's view in the Megillah. And one of those ways, one of the messages I believe they're trying to send here is the same accentuation that people's roles are changing. Esther's role is changing just from being that wife that he picked out to someone who's really someone very special and who he's able to look at himself.
So he was sitting, couldn't sleep, and there she was.
right across from him. He says, Esther, what are you doing here? He spoke to her directly. It doesn't say Vayomer Yomer, the two Yomers, when he first spoke to her when she's standing by the gate. And she says, you know, the first invitation.
Mm-hmm. All right, so it should be...
And he spoke to her directly on page 35, except to ask her during the wine feast, what was your request? It doesn't say the Yomer Yomer in the Hebrew.
Right, so...
And then when... now came the third Esther, Dom Royalty, stood in the inner court facing mm-hmm. the king. When the king noticed Esther, that's on page 33.
Mm-hmm.
She won his favor. The king extended his scepter to her and said to her,
mm-hmm.
okay, look at the Hebrew, Yomer la Hamelach, Malach, Esther.
Right. So I believe that the Talmud would say that, I mean, you could really approach it in a couple of ways. The simplest way would be to say, they say, yes, until now, he was speaking through a translator always. He had his translator, trusty translators around. We don't know what languages Esther may or may have not spoken. That could be one approach. The other approach would be to say the Talmud may not be intending this as literally what took place, but again, simply trying to give us a play. Perhaps it was that the king felt this way until now. You know, I practically need to use a translator. She's a nobody. I'm not saying which one was actually the one that took place in the actual Purim story. We don't know. We weren't there. And this gets into, you know, sort of the different levels of interpretation that, in general, we have within the Bible as to sort of what plane of interpretation we call it this works within. Is this, again, sort of a comment that's not meant to be taken literally about what actually occurred, or is this a comment that indeed is? The point is, though, that irrelevant of whether or not he was actually speaking to her through a translator beforehand or afterwards, is that we're still getting this idea that the rabbis are trying to project a certain image of what's taking place during this interaction. And I think that that's to emphasize some of the other things they see in the text. And the truth is, if you look at the text in chapter 7 as a whole, you'll notice a lot of sort of rereadings and double usages of words and poetic repetition in a couple of places. Some of which the rabbis pick up on, some of which the rabbis pick up on but chose not to comment on. And through that, they're sort of trying to give us a bit more of the way they understood what was taking place here. So that's the way sort of I would frame this. Again, was I there? I wasn't there. I don't know if there was actually a translator sitting at the table all of these times that it says he said to her. Could have been there was, it could have been there wasn't, but I don't think that's sort of great importance to the actual plot of the story as opposed to the ideas that we can take when the rabbis tell us sort of this little suggestion or commentary to this double usage of Vayomer. But let's see if we can continue on for now. There's one other very interesting thing here. Again, it's sort of that, again, strange wording that is focused on. Vatomer Esther. Okay, we're up to 7:6 now. Esther said, Ish tsar ve'oyev, Haman hara hazeh. Ish tsar ve'oyev means an enemy, an adversary, a man who is an enemy or an adversary. And then it says, Haman hara hazeh. It's a bit strange. She should have said, Vatomer Esther, Haman. Okay, or Haman hara hazeh, or Haman ish tsar ve'oyev. But why this sort of strange awkward phrase, Ish tsar ve'oyev, Haman harazeh. So Rabbi Elazar said, this teaches that she was in fact pointing towards Achashverosh, indicating that in fact he was an adversary, an enemy, and an angel came and pushed her hand towards Haman. Okay? So, again, according to the Talmud, she says, Ish tsar ve'oyev, she's pointing towards Achashverosh, says, you're the bad guy. And an angel comes and boom, suddenly your hand is pointing towards Haman. There's a lot to unpack, especially with this one. And again, it's sort of strange. I mean, until now, what it seems is, and let's think of this from the Jewish perspective, we don't know what the Jews knew about Haman and Haman initiating the decree. We know it. The decree went out signed with the king's ring. There must have been some inklings, but Haman was just a chief advisor. I don't know. And we don't know how much the Jews knew about Haman. It could very well have been that Ahasuerus was looked upon as a villain. The king has sent out these rulings. And Ahasuerus is, to some extent, guilty. Again, there are different approaches in the Talmud itself, whether Ahasuerus was inherently evil or whether he was just foolish and didn't know what, you know, didn't know how to properly discern what his advisors were telling him, and therefore he was just doing whatever he was told and didn't really know better. But now again, we're switching. Suddenly, the target and the way to get rid of this evil decree is Haman. And we're going to talk back towards this angel theme a little bit later with what the Ibn Ezra has to say. But I want to continue with the angel theme for 1 minute to fill out the rest of the chapter in a very midrashic format. And that is here, for some reason, there's a section missing in the English translation here, which I just noticed today after I'd already sent in the source sheet, but I'll try to fill it in as best as I can. In Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, which is an early midrash, we're told, sort of a running commentary. We're given sort of a running commentary on Esther, just like in the Talmud. And it says, the king arose in his wrath, and he went to the Ginat HaBitan, to his garden. And it says, he went there, and then he came back. It doesn't really say what he did there or what was going on. It just says he came back to the Mishnah, and maybe he went for a walk to clear his head. So the Midrash tells us, Ma asa Michael, what did the angel Michael do? Hitchil mekatzetz netiot lefanav. He began to cut down all of the plants in front of the king. So you can imagine the king walks out and there's a man there chopping down his trees. So the king says, hey, what are you doing? So Amar lo, and this is where, again, there's a little bit of a, there must have been a section missing from the English translation. So the king says to this person, which is the angel Michael, Mazeh, what are you doing? He says, Amar lo, he said to him, oh, I don't think you understand. Animi banav shel Haman. I'm one of Haman's sons. Shekach tzivani ama, Abba. This is what my father told me to do. He said we need wood. The king says, you're in my orchard chopping down my trees. What are you doing? Miyad v'chamato ba'aravo. And that's when the king really got mad. You can imagine. Esther's just accused Haman in front of him of trying to kill out her nation. So he says, let me go clear my head. He walks into his beautiful orchard that he has in the courtyard of his palace. And he sees one of Haman's sons chopping down his trees. You can imagine how mad he was. V'nivar chima al chima. And his anger added upon his anger, hotter and hotter. His intense wrath was kindled within him. And the king returned from the palace garden to the palace of the banquet of the wine, which is now back in the English translation. What did the angel Michael do? He lifted up Haman upon Esther. Meaning, it says, V'haman no fail. Haman was falling. What does V'haman no fail mean? So, he could have tripped. Yeah. He could have lost his balance somehow, yeah. Says this Midrash again, as well as various other Midrashic sources, no. Michael wasn't done with just cutting down the trees in the orchard. He disappears from the orchard, boom, appears in the room right as Ahasuerus enters, and he shoves Haman, or he lifts him up, over Esther, according to this. And the king exclaimed again, as for this villain, he is not satisfied with having purchased the people of Esther to destroy, to slay, and to cause to perish, but he must needs come upon her? Will he even force the queen before me in the house, as we said? Haman heard this word, and his countenance fell. As it is said, they covered Haman's face. And we're not done with the angels yet. So we've got the angel Michael, who's now posed as one of Haman's children, and he's chopping down trees. That gets the king really mad. He's now pushed Haman onto Esther. That gets the king even madder and madder. Says the Midrash, and again, this is found in many, many other places, and the king commanded that he should be hanged on the gallows. Again, this may not necessarily be exactly there, but what did Elijah, his memory be a blessing to? He assumed... And these are all questions that I hope to answer as we continue through. But Elijah appears. We're done with Michael. And Elijah shows up. So he decides, it's Purim. I want to dress up. Who does he dress up as? Harvona. And he assumes the guise of Harvona, one of the chamberlains of the king. He said to him, O Lord, O King, there is a tree in Haman's house, taken from the Holy of Holies, 50 cubits high. And this is another Midrashic sort of insertion, which we're not going to go through. And then the Midrash goes further. And it's Elijah who's posing as Harvona. And in fact, some commentaries even note that Harvona here is spelled slightly differently than Harvona at the beginning. The original Harvona, so to say, is spelled with an aleph at the end. This one is spelled with a hey at the end because God sort of intervened in this one. But either way, this is Elijah who comes forward and he suggests that the king hang him on this tree. He's hanged on this tree. And again, we move on to the next chapter where, you know, you can see the continuation of the running commentary. If you skip down a few lines, right, forthwith the king commanded that he should be hanged thereon, as it is said, and the king said, hang him thereon, so as to fulfill that which is said, let a beam be pulled out from his house, which is a verse in Ezra. And it also says, so they hanged Haman on the gallows that he prepared for Mordechai. The king took all that belonged to Haman, gives it to Mordechai and Esther, and that's the continuation of the Megillah. So we've seen how with the matter of actions, God says, you know what, now's the time for me to intervene. And boom, he sends this angel to do this and causes this to happen. This angel to do this and causes that to happen. The next angel to do that causes that to happen. And all of a sudden, we go from the king loving Haman to the king absolutely despising him for all of these different reasons that have sort of all magically stacked up. And in fact, that's what happens. Mordechai is saved. Haman is killed in his place. And one of the verses that is quoted is that from Mishlei, from Proverbs, Tzadik mitzara nechlat, the righteous, is delivered out of trouble, v'yava rasha tachtav, and the wicked cometh in his stead. This is exactly what's taking place here. We began it in the last chapter a little bit, saying Mordechai is honored in place of the wicked, but now we had Mordechai who was supposed to be hanged as the Jews were all going to be killed, and we say his spot in the gallows is no longer reserved parking for him. The king says, that's where you've got to hang Haman, through Harvona. And although this is all very nice and dandy for a child's fairy tale, it really kind of disconnects us from the Megillah when we read Midrashim like this. I mean, the whole Megillah, the way it's presented by the rabbis and by many of the commentaries, is for all that we say it's supposed to be, you know, natural and God's name doesn't appear, it's God working behind the scenes. It seems quite miraculous to me. Once I'm reading all these stories, well, this angel came and did this, this angel came and did that, Elijah appears here, he does this, he does that. That's not so natural. And it's also kind of hard to relate to. And for that, I bring you one of the first people who found it very hard to relate to, and how he decided to understand these comments of the rabbis and others in our chapter and elsewhere. The first time that we sort of see classically an angel interfering in the story of the Megillah is where? Anybody think back to chapter 1? What does he do? Vashti. Right? We have Vashti, and the Midrash tells us that she grew a tail. It says, Ba Gavriel ve'asa la zanav. Gavriel came and made her, fashioned her a tail. So again, this is, you know, we're talking about a story that we are always told is always, it's a political miracle, God's working behind the scenes. I'm pretty sure anybody that saw Vashti growing a tail was not thinking that. They're thinking, holy smokes, where'd she get a tail from? And it says to Ibn Ezra there in source number 5. And regarding the understanding of the Midrashic opinion that Gavriel came and appended a tail to Vashti, this can be explained as a pimple that sprouted on her skin or on her face. And God made her disgusting in his eyes, as if she was an animal that had a tail. And they attributed this action to Gavriel, since all of God's actions are through the angels, and it mentioned Gavriel specifically, since he helped the Jews, as written in the book of Daniel. So says Ibn Ezra, when the rabbis are making statements like this, or at least particularly with this statement, she had a little bit of an acne breakout. And the rabbis were trying to emphasize something. They weren't meaning to say that literally Gavriel descended and stuck a tail on Vashti and then forced her to come out in front of Ahasuerus and everybody was laughing because she has a tail. No, she wasn't looking the greatest that day. She had something, you know, on her face that makeup couldn't quite cover up. And therefore, The tail part is, what is tails? Animals have tails. Animals are considered gross. So from Ahasuerus's perspective, it was as if Vashti had grown a tail. It was like so ridiculous, so gross. I can't possibly even look at you. You look like a horse. You look like a whatever. Why? It's as if she grew a tail. And says Ibn Ezra, Gavriel wasn't physically involved. He didn't paint anything on her face. He didn't cause any of this to happen. It's because God's actions are through angels, which, you know, the philosophy of this could have, you know, many, many shiurim of its own. But he's saying it's a way that God did something in a very natural way, but simply expressed it. And it's being expressed by the Talmud, says Ibn Ezra, and by the various other Midrashim, as being something supernatural, as a way of explaining how things naturally worked. It's easier to relate to. And the purpose of this Midrash, says Ibn Ezra, it's the purpose of it is to show that just like, you know, having a pimple appear just on the wrong day is something that can really ruin everything, you can see that that was from God too. Don't think for a moment that it was just, you know, bad face day for Vashti and bad luck for her. No, God's also orchestrating that. And that's the first of these, you know, comments that we see that the Midrash makes on things like this. If we continue, okay? If we look to our chapter, the next comment of Ibn Ezra. V'hamelech shav miginat habitan. V'haman nofel al hamita. And I forgot to mention earlier, Haman nofel, I was thinking to myself, it means Haman was falling. Where did we talk about Haman falling? For those of you who are here right from the very beginning, right at the end of the previous chapter, Haman's wife tells him, if you've begun to fall because of the Jews, you will continue to be falling. And you will fall and fall and fall. And this is an example of, you know, sort of acute double meaning where you can look at it and you can say, yes, he was falling on the bed, but this was his fall from height, his fall from power that was continuing. And that's why it doesn't say, V'haman nafal, Haman fell. It's V'haman no fell, he's still falling. This is all still happening. But what's interesting is, again, Ibn Ezra cites, you know, this midrashic opinion that we mentioned, Yesh Omer, some say, Shehamalach Techafo, that it was the angel that pushed Haman over. Vinafal, and therefore he fell. Vyesh Omrim, and some say, Kol Nafal Alpanav Lefaneha, that he fell on his face in front of her, probably to plead for his life. That's what it means, he fell. And Ahasuerus mistook this. And you know what he says, V'hanachon, the correct understanding is, Ki biroto hamelech sheshav, when he saw the king returning, Nafal Merov Pachdo. He fell over from his great fear. He's standing there, he's saying, Esther, please forgive me. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to kill your nation. He looks back and Ahasuerus comes in, bright red face. You remember, again, in the Midrash, right? He just finished seeing Haman's sons chopping down his apple orchard. And we'll see how Ibn Ezra might relate to that as well. He looks back, he's like, and he falls over. Now, for Ibn Ezra, that isn't incompatible with what the rabbis say. It's not that either the angel pushed him or he fell over. He could perhaps say, and I'm not sure that he's not saying that, in fact, is that the angel pushing him is another way for saying natural causes. He looks around, it's as if an angel pushed him. It's not like, you know, he tripped over something, and even if he would have tripped over something, you could compare that to the angel. But it's just saying that natural cause that we have coming from the Megillah and all of these different pieces that are falling into place naturally is what could be considered a malach. And as we continue on to Harvona, we see that even more. And certainly this, you know, I'm going to go through Harvona and then I'm going to get back to the apple orchard and try to put things all together in one piece as to sort of how we're looking at this chapter. And he goes one step further. Vayomer Harvona. Okay, so first he says, Divrei Yachid ki Harvonahu Eliyahu. It is a single opinion that Harvona was Eliyahu Hanavi, Zachur Latov. Ulefi dati, in my understanding, Shehatam Shezeh HaSarisu HaNizkar B'Tchilat HaSefer. Says, why is it that this opinion amongst the rabbis says that? Why is it that we say Harvona is Eliyahu dressed up in disguise? What could possibly, you know, be a motivation for that? So he says, I'll tell you why. This officer was mentioned at the beginning of the book, Yihume Hazayna Sarisim, that he was one of the seven officers who were evil. Asa Tovali Yisrael, and he did good for the Jewish people. Uva'a Yeshua al Yado, Ki'ilu Eliyahu Zal Haya. and a salvation came through him as if he was Eliyahu HaNavi. Meaning, first of all, number one, as he mentions, Haya Shehu HaBasar Bevohai Shuha Boser Bevohai Yeshua, that number one, he's going to be the one who brings us the good tidings of the coming of the salvation. But number two, right, I don't know if whenever you were kids, you know, something happened, you say, it's Eliyahu HaNavi doing it. It was completely unexpected. It was completely out of the blue. It made no sense. It was just, wow, as if it was Eliyahu HaNavi. So says Ibn Ezra, what does it mean that Harvona was Eliyahu? Was it literally Eliyahu, you know, floating around, putting on a disguise, dressing up as Harvona? No. What actually happened was, it was so miraculous, such an amazing salvation that came out from this, and such a change, it was as if Eliyahu had appeared and done it. But that's Ibn Ezra's approach. To take a look back at what the rabbis say here in all of these places with what's happening that's miraculous and say that's not literally what happened miraculously. That's not how God was playing puppeteer. He wasn't swapping out characters. He wasn't adding in angels to trip people up and give people tales. These were all natural consequences of what was taking place throughout the Megillah, and they are illustrated to us by using these comparisons to show that God is the one who's operating this the same way. And now when we look back at Malach Michael, at the angel Michael who was supposedly chopping down trees, these were all different occurrences that were actually happening in real life. Haman needed firewood. Haman sent one of his sons to go chop some wood. Bad luck that guess what happened to happen right then? The king storms out angrily. Maybe on another day they wouldn't have been such a big deal. And all of these little details are all of the rest of the details of the story coming together. And so everything that had happened until now is all happening at exactly the same time, arranged by God, but not in a miraculous fashion, says Ibn Ezra, specifically in a non-miraculous fashion, which that all coming together is what makes the Megillah so amazing in terms of a story. Because there weren't angels floating around. It was just the people doing their natural actions that had those consequences. And by looking at the consequences that these little things had, Harvona was the one to help Haman build the gallows. And that's another, you know, opinion amongst the rabbis. Harvona was actually the one who built the gallows. He was intending to hang Mordechai. But it so happened to be that he saw the king was angry with Haman, so he decided, you know what, I'm going to jump onto the other bandwagon. And again, that's why he's like Eliyahu. And all of these actions that were taking place, it's as if an angel had come and done this because everything fit into place so well. All the puzzle came together. And what I'd like to conclude with in the last few minutes here is to continue on to wonder aloud, why is it that we look at Harvona as such a good character then? If you look throughout the Torah, and if we think about the way we ourselves would look at it, we don't like people who suddenly switch sides, you know, when the going is good. You know, okay, I'm going to jump over. Harvona, according to what we see so far, and the way we simply understand the Megillah, is a bad guy. He's on Haman's team. And he comes in, the king's mad at Haman. He says, great, I'm going to have a fantastic opportunity. I'm going to get on the king's good side. He says, hang Haman, great idea. And we forever say, be like Harvona. Harvona's great. Harvona zachur latov. And if you're comparing Harvona and Eliyahu and you actually literally think that it was Eliyahu, which certainly there are people that say so, the Zachur Latov fits in very well. Both of them are referred to as Zachur Latov in different places. But there is something that's a little bit bothersome. I'll use another medrash to illustrate this. One of the earliest bandwagon jumpers that I'm aware of in Tanakh was someone by the name of Haran. Anybody knows who Haran was? Abraham's brother, very good. And in the famous Midrash about Abraham being cast in to the fiery furnace by Nimrod, who basically, Abraham decided that idol worship wasn't quite for him, and he made a bit of a mockery of idol worship. Abraham's father, Terach, brings him to Nimrod, who was the ruler at that time, and Nimrod, in this story, throws Abraham into a furnace, and Abraham, of course, emerges alive miraculously. What parallels that has to the story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah is also another, you know, shear for another time. And what Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah... Okay, anyways, let's stop there, actually. And in that Midrash, the Midrash tells us the following. Haran, Avram's brother, was actually standing at the sideline. And he said, I know what's going to happen. I don't know what I should do. Should I do idol worship, or should I trust in Avraham's God? So I'll tell you. Perfect idea. I'll look. If Nimrod beats up Abraham, but, you know, burns him to ashes in the furnace, I'll be on Nimrod's side. And you know what? If Avram comes out of the oven victorious, then I'll know to be on Avram's side. And in fact, that's what happens. What does Haran do? Haran says, me too! I'm also going to follow God. And Nimrod says, great! Into the furnace! And Haran dies. And that's why it says, Vayamat Haran al Panei Terech Aviv. That's what the Midrash tells us. So the Midrash is saying that we don't like bandwagon jumpers. What's this business here? You got to believe in what you believe in. Don't just be someone who's riding, you know, riding the waves on their surfboard, and when this wave is here, you ride that one, otherwise you're going to jump to the other team. That's not something that we generally like. But yet in the Megillah and yet in the Purim, Charvon is such a central character. Why? What is so special about him? And I think it's Charvona that represents exactly what we've been talking about all night. Charvona is someone who, yes, we wouldn't necessarily look at as such a great person. But his role in the Megillah, as just what someone regular might do and what someone not even that great might do, is to be that representative of a regular natural occurrence that turns the entire story around. Charvona is the one responsible for having Haman hanged. Why? All because he did something very normal and natural. It wasn't Eliyahu. It wasn't some miraculous salvation, and that's why we're happy with him. We're happy with him because that was just a regular, plain part of what was taking place. It was a regular advisor of the king who decides, I want to find favor in the king's eyes. And when that was the case, Charvona is really representative of the whole change that's going on. It's all natural, but happens in exactly the right place at exactly the right time, that ends up being the, in this case, the straw that breaks the camel's back, or the straw that breaks Haman's neck, the noose that breaks Haman's neck, and causes him to be hanged. And I think when that's the case, and we can go back and look through this chapter, and we go back and we think about who Charvona was and why we put so much emphasis on him, we can see that this is not only the key turnaround in the Megillah, where Charvona switched from side one to side two, but that's not unexpected. Where Esther is revealed as being from royalty, not so unexpected, just happens to happen right now. And Haman is revealed to not really be doing such great things for the king, happens now. Haman is scared by Ahasuerus walking in, falls on Esther's bed, happens now. None of this has to be miraculous, but all of the natural occurrences coming together are miraculous, and that's what really causes the turnaround, and that's why I think we celebrate Charvona so much, even though we don't look at him as a great guy, because he was representative of this sort of natural happening that all comes together in the right place at the right time to make the good guys win and the bad guys lose. So thank you very much. I hope that gave a new perspective on some of the Midrashim and the Megillah, as well as this chapter, and I'll wish you in advance, you know, a happy Purim. I doubt I'll see many of you before Purim, so thank you very, very much again for hosting me, and thank you, Rabbi Kanofsky and Shul.